journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, October 26, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
At the Tea Party, the wingnuts, whack jobs, and whitey whiteness of the new Republican right, and why we should take it seriously. We'll have a conversation with Laura Flanders, plus foreclosure fraud, the Latino vote, and the People's Marketplace.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. With the midterm election just days away, much is being made of the influence of the Tea Party movement and the inevitability of a Republican sweep of Congress, especially of the House. However, a report in Sunday's edition of the Washington Post suggests that the number of Tea Partiers may be inflated. The Post's Amy Gardner writes that the Tea Party is, quote, not so much a movement as a disparate band of vaguely connected gatherings that do surprisingly little to engage in the political process. The paper attempted to verify the existence of more than 2,300 Tea Party groups identified by the Tea Party Patriots website and found that only 647 of them were reachable and verifiable. Yet this loose network of ultra-conservatives have managed to alter the political landscape in a very short time, likely affecting the outcome of next week's election. A new book published by OR Books and edited by journalist and writer Laura Flanders focuses on the Tea Party, its politics, and progressive responses to it. The book's title summarizes it well: At the Tea Party, the Wingnuts, Whack Jobs, and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right, and Why We Should Take It Seriously. At the Tea Party has essays by Max Blumenthal, Alexander Coburn, Lisa Dugan, Bill Fletcher, Gren Greenwald, Arun Gupta, Chris Hedges, Katha Pollitt, Sarah Posner, Tim Wise, Alexander Zaychik, and many, many others. I spoke recently with Laura Flanders about the book. She's the host and founder of Grit TV, author of the New York Times bestseller Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. She also writes for The Nation and The Huffington Post and is a regular contributor to MSNBC. Welcome to Uprising, Laura Flanders.
I'm so glad to be with you, Sonali. What a treat.
Thanks so much for joining us. So the rise of the Tea Party phenomenon has been pretty amazing. They first emerged around Tax Day 2009, pretty much in conjunction with the Obama administration starting its tenure. And then they seemed to really gain steam during the healthcare town hall meetings in the summer of 2009 with some very memorable images of signs like, get the government out of my Medicare. How do you describe overall the trajectory of this movement and the speed with which it is taken a hold of the national political landscape?
Well, one thing, never to criticize you, Sonali, but to counter the contemporary kind of popular story that this is all just a sudden explosion since Obama came to office, we see, those of us who've contributed to this book at the Tea Party, a much longer historical story here. As far as I can see, sure, there are some new things about the current moment. Barack Obama in the White House. You've got the moment, the media control, you've got the money on the right that we've never seen before. And part of the explosion of the last 2 years is to do with the coming together of those three things in, you know, whole new ways. But what isn't new is the kind of group that is feeding into the Tea Party movement. We're talking about religious right extremists, gun rights extremists, anti-tax resistors, anti-environmental resistors, you name it. Those forces, and couple them with the libertarian folks who've been out there for decades, they have been growing in strength and receiving big money support ever since the early 1980s. So we're talking about, I say in my introduction, not the beginning of something, but, well, I call it the Bacchanal, the coming to age of a kind of, I describe this as a kind of orgiastic celebration of the victory of the irrational. It wasn't just 2 years in the making. It was well over two decades. And I think that's important for folks on the other side of the spectrum to bear in mind. This isn't just new stuff.
Now, in your introduction, you place Glenn Beck, the Fox News shock jock, at the heart of the Tea Party movement, their demigod, if you will. But does that give him too much credit? Would there be a Tea Party movement if there was no Glenn Beck?
Well, it's a very good question, Sonali. And I think there have been a few media players that have helped the movement along, but none with greater personal investment and association than Beck. I also think Beck is a very good example of a case history of a man who, with no particular politics, who has ridden a tide of right-wing agenda funding, if you would like, to where he is today. So that he is not just a creator of the Tea Parties, but like so much of the groups that have gone into this movement, he is a creature of the last 30 years. Where does he come from? He comes essentially from media consolidation and insanity in talk radio, insanity chasing ratings. Here's a guy who was on, you know, two-bit stations that were able to catapult him into the national spotlight thanks to media consolidation under the Telecom Act of 1996, signed by Bill Clinton. Before 2000, Glenn Beck hardly had any politics except for how to beat the ratings of the other guy on the dial. It was in 2000 that he realized, oh, he could make some name for himself by focusing on the election recount in Florida. He was down there then. And then he rode that tide of attention that he got to more national stations, first in Pennsylvania, then in New York, and finally after 9/11 to national prominence and national syndication. But again, if we hadn't had media consolidation, the kind of telecom-permitted consolidation of talk radio that we saw in the 1990s and that exacerbated the rise of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, there would be no Glenn Beck. And I think without Glenn Beck, the Tea Parties wouldn't be as they are today. So he's an interesting case history on a number of levels.
Now, many people on the left complain that the Tea Party already gets way too much attention from the press, right? When the lefties show up in large numbers for demonstration, their rallies get just a fraction of the media coverage of a Tea Party rally. Yet you say in your subtitle to your book that we should take the Tea Party seriously.
Well, I think there's seriously, and then there's, you know, slavishly. I think that what we've seen is way too much attention, not challenging some of the crazy ideas put forward and made kind of normal by Tea Party rhetoric, and too little attention by some of the real grievances that the Tea Party movement is building off, is manipulating. So when I say take them seriously, and clearly the headline of the book, the subtitle of the book, wants it both ways, yeah, wingnuts, whack jobs, whitey, whiteness, and we should take it seriously. I'm saying two things. On the one hand, there's plenty about this that's hysterical, and there's nothing for us to learn there except for there are a lot of people who will get a lot of airtime by being as extremist as they can. But the part that we need to take seriously, I think, is that there is a degree to which the left, for lack of a better term, have failed to become the kind of force that this Tea Party right is becoming on the flank of the Republican Party. On the left, all too many progressives and left folks decided to zip the lip when Barack Obama got elected. And on key issues of economic justice in particular, I think we saw territory ceded to, well, first a vacuum and then the Tea Party movement.
So it sounds as though you agree with Chris Hedges's analysis. He has a piece in your book and also has his own book out about how the Democrats and Obama, had they done a better job giving ordinary Americans more relief, had they felt more pressure from the left, maybe the Tea Party wouldn't be as strong today. And so in a sense, we are where we are because Democrats and liberals essentially sold out ordinary Americans from the Democrats' perspective, sold them out literally for campaign contributions and, you know, have bought into free market fundamentalism. And then from left, left progressive organizations were so excited about having someone like Obama that we just exchanged our silence for a seat at the table.
Yeah. Well, I think there's always the tricky question of who's the we in any of these sentences. But
right.
In broad strokes, I think what you've just described is absolutely right. And there's a moment that haunts me, and I mentioned at the end of the introduction, in the beginning of the Tea Party visibility mode, if you will, meaning in February, March, April of 2009, the real spark, the first time Tea Party got used, was on February 19th, where you have the CNBC reporter on the stock market floor making some rant direct to camera about mortgage relief. And he used the word Tea Party, talking about the degree to which taxpayers don't want to have to bail out their failed neighbors. And you have all these stockbrokers, people whose industry had just been bailed out by taxpayers during the bank bailout. You know, they didn't mind that, but they were screaming and yelling support for Rick Santelli as he spoke, and it became known as Rick Santelli's rant. Two things happened after that. Conservative websites associated to groups with groups like Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers funded organization, just lit a fire under that video clip. It went viral in hours, and the Tea Party movement, you could say, kind of grew out of that. What happened the week before that, just days before that, and this is what haunts me, is that you had that Working Families Party tour with Acorn in Connecticut of the houses of the rich and infamous. These were those bankers and finance industry folks who had received huge bonuses after their own firms had been bailed out by us. And the working families in Acorn took poor people from Hartford, Connecticut, one of the toughest hit cities on the East Coast, to those homes, not with pitchforks, but with just a letter, come and visit where we live, to that effect. It got some media attention. It got some people rattled. There were some tough questions raised of Timothy Geithner and others on the floor of Congress about the bailout. And that very week, word is from people we had on Grit TV, that the White House said, whoa, ratchet this back. We don't want to be targeting bankers. We don't want to be endangering stockbrokers' families. And we want your support for our stimulus package, which was also passed in that week. I have the question, the same question Chris has. If mobilizations like the working families had continued, would that territory have been better contested between the right and the left? What happened was we kind of left fury, we abandoned fury about the bailout to the right and to the Tea Partiers who became right, whoever some of those people started as being. That, I think, is a very good question, but it's not over yet. And, you know, I'll just say that one of the pieces I'm proudest of in the book is the transcript of a session held in the Northwest last summer, this summer just passed, where on-the-ground organizers talk about fighting back. And I think it shows just what can be done with very little.
I'm speaking with Laura Flanders. She's the editor of the brand new book, At the Tea Party, The Wingnuts, Whack Jobs and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right, and Why We Should Take It Seriously. She's also the host and founder of Grit TV. So I want to go back to some of these figures in the Tea Party movement. If Glenn Beck is the demigod of the Tea Party movement, is Sarah Palin the demigoddess? And, you know, given that her endorsement, her political endorsement these days is not necessarily a surefire benefit, and then even conservatives don't seem to agree on her, what role does she play in the Tea Party? Or is she just there because she loves being in the limelight?
Well, I think that she certainly loves being in the limelight. Why she's there has a lot of things wrapped up in it. I think on the one hand, this is a kind of continuation of the Bush woman phenomenon that I wrote about a few books back, of a very conservative set of policies wrapped up in a very female-friendly, family-friendly-looking face. I mean, that is, unless you're a female who wants to make decisions about their family, like how many children do you want in it without being locked in jail for having an abortion. This is a woman who espouses some of the most right-wing conservative rhetoric, when it makes sense, that you're going to find in Republican circles. And yet at the same time, she has an appeal as being a regular female face that has turned on a lot of pundits and a lot of commentators, and frankly, I think, has given license to a lot of women to feel that they belong in politics, that now, there's a place for them in politics. And that's one of the things addressed in this book, too.
You use the words turned on, and there's a contribution to your book called Is Sarah Palin Porn? And, you know, I have to bring up this question. How much of her own sort of physical characteristics, the fact that she is an attractive woman and polls much better among men than among women. What does that also say about this new Republican right?
Well, what did you think, Sonali? I mean, I had my questions about Jack Hitt's pieces, Sarah Palin Porn, but I thought in the end it did speak a truth to the fact that we have an entirely ambivalent relationship to all things sexual, physical, lusty, any of that on the campaign trail and, frankly, off it. I think he makes an important point that this is a woman who is using her, if you will, kind of sexual guile to take people aback, if nothing else. And you're right, there is a huge gender imbalance when it comes to her support. But it does have to be said that there are women who are working their hearts out for Tea Party candidates. Is it the kind of massive upsurge that you might have heard written about? Not to that extent, and Betsy Reed talks about it in this book. But there is nonetheless, I think, a lesson again for other parties, let's just say, about how out of place and underappreciated many women still feel. I mean, the Blue Grip book was out a few years back. I talked to Democratic women, the core of the Democratic Party, who were so frustrated with how they're treated by their own, that when I saw this kind of leadership role, if not given, then at least taken by a female candidate on the sort of on the Tea Party right, I thought that's going to catch on, and it did. I think, again, there's something to be learned here. There's also a reality to the fact that a very unorganized, almost anarchic at some level, I don't want to say unorganized, they have a lot of money from some very organized people, but a movement, a sort of constellation of small groups that are still in formation and haven't ossified in structure yet, provide some opportunity for women to take leadership in a way that usually the more established parties don't.
Let's talk about the relationship between lobbyists and the Tea Party. In the book, At the Tea Party, there's a piece by Mike Madden called Lobbyist Money Plus Right-Wing Extremists Equals Tea Party. But It's interesting, if the Tea Party is harping on about big corporations getting bailed out, how does this relationship work?
I think there's some hypocrisy there, Sonali. I mean, not to be glib, but of course there's hypocrisy at the root of much of what the Tea Party puts up as its positions. We're for the regular guy, but you've got Sharon Angle in Nevada saying, the unemployed aren't, are selfish and lazy and dependent. We're for, rolling back the power of big business, even as we're for rolling back any kind of regulation on big business, any kind of financial regulation. But that's part of the issue of the moment and the money. Post-Citizens United, you have unlimited campaign money flowing into races this election, something like $150 million on the independent side alone so far, as we're speaking of a few days before the election. There's going to be more yet. That kind of money for both advertising and lobbying and the kind of, no demand on the transparency side when it comes to the campaign advertising is perfectly suited to the rise of something that's presenting itself as a populist revolt, but is actually something very different.
I want to turn to the part of the book which in your subtitle you title the whitey whiteness of the Republic of the Tea Party movement. This is an interesting piece in the book about by Julie Ingersoll called Tea Party Essay, Slavery Not Race Related. And I think I must have missed the story. I just probably wanted to miss the story about the NAACPC as opposed to the NAACP. What is this formation and how is it related to the Tea Party?
Well, again, there have always been and there have now been for, well, very clearly since the Reagan era, there's always been a strategy on the right-hand side to develop women's groups and people of color-dominated groups that were conservative-funded organizations articulating conservative critique of, the Democratic Party and the Democratic policy agenda. And I think that's exactly what this is. It's another organization that has, we don't know how many members, I suspect not as many as their attention in the media merits, but puts forward people of color, particularly African-American faces. It's an effort to split the Democratic voting base and to kind of confront people like Ben Jealous at the NAACP, who say there's racism within Tea Party ranks. However, there is, I'm afraid, no denying, folks, there are white supremacists wrapped up at the very highest levels of the Tea Parties, as a recent report from the NAACP points out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think real researchers are going to be persuaded by a few faces when the facts and the institutional connections are as tight as they are, not to mention the language on those signs is pretty explicit.
So is it true then that the Tea Party, if you look, I mean, I don't know if anyone's been able to do any kind of statistical analysis because the Tea Party is not a formalized institution with membership, but I wonder if there was a way to statistically break down the demographics of the Tea Party, would we be looking at an organization that's more than 90% white?
Whitey whiteness, that's what you got. I mean, every poll that has been done shows, whiteness in the 90%. Are there a few people of color? Do media search them out for sure? But any poll you want to look at, this is a party that is, a group of people that is way disproportionately older, whiter, and frankly, more male than the population as a whole.
And just to go back to what I mentioned earlier, the NAACPC is essentially this organization that is meant to counter the NAACP's work, and it stands for, I'm going to look it up right here, the National Association for the Advancement of Conservative People of All Colors.
Right.
So they are essentially rewriting history. This piece says that slavery was not about race, which is
about self-determination and states' rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not new. This is not new storytelling, but it is newly hitched to Tea Party entity. It's doing exactly what you remember. The Independent Women's Forum. They were the folks who stood up. Women. They were originally Women for Clarence Thomas. Well, this is the African Americans for white supremacy. Same thing.
I've been speaking with Laura Flanders, the editor of the new book, At the Tea Party, The Wingnuts, Whack Jobs, and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right, and Why We Should Take It Seriously. You've been listening to part one of my interview. You can listen to part two tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. You can get the book online at orbooks.com and find out more about Laura Flanders and her show Grit TV at grittv.org. This is Uprising. After this week's edition of The People's Marketplace, we'll learn about foreclosure fraud. How widespread is it and what exactly does it mean? And later in the hour, Antonio Gonzalez will join us to discuss the Latino vote in next week's upcoming election. Stay tuned.
Why can't I ever come out ahead of the bank?
Those guys are all crooks.
We want to take out a hefty one.
Giant secret charges may apply.
Money!
Oh my God!
Money. Well, I wanted to be so nice so I could save money.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round.
Well, we gotta get back and move on.
Tell me what's gonna.
While pundits and economists worry about Wall Street's well-being, Americans worry about losing their jobs, paying their bills, and the health of the planet. The capitalist marketplace promotes the exploitation of people and natural resources as cheap fixes. But we don't have to abandon our values to save a buck. Welcome to The People's Marketplace. I'm Martina Steiner. Halloween is only the beginning of a holiday season that is sure to frighten loving parents with little cash to spare. Leave the screams for the haunted house and start talking to your kids about ways the whole family can pitch in to make the upcoming holidays fun and affordable. It's easy to cut costs on Halloween. Don't worry about buying enough candy for the whole neighborhood. Only buy what you can afford. Or ditch the sugary snacks completely and check out a teacher supply store or 99-cent store for cheap Halloween bag stuffers, like pumpkin-shaped erasers or plastic spiders. When it comes to costumes, kids are bombarded with the message that they need store-bought versions of the newest Disney character or superhero. Tell them you want to help them be more creative and help the family save money by putting together a costume from what you have at home or what you can find from a secondhand clothes store. It may be a hard sell at first, but if you get excited, your kids just may follow your lead. Turn costumes into a fun family project. For help on how to talk to your kids about the ways advertising shapes their ideas about what is desirable and cool, check out the website for the Canadian organization Media Awareness Network at www.media-awareness.ca. It has resources to help parents navigate conversations on topics like marketing, movie violence, and stereotypes in the media. For parents who are short on time, sewing skills, or both, making a costume can be a daunting task, but there is help. Check out the website www.costumes.familyeducation.com for tons of genuinely easy and cute homemade costume ideas and instructions. Many require no sewing at all and can be lovingly thrown together in about 30 minutes. Among the many options you will find are instructions for a pirate, a mummy, a flamingo, and a lamp, which is perfect for the kid with a sense of humor who wants to go overboard decorating an old lampshade to wear as a hat. If the whole costume and candy scene is too much to deal with this year, don't do it. Get a scary movie and some popcorn or a sweet treat and have a family night at home. Make Halloween cookies or cupcakes together, or have a Halloween art party night. So, don't run screaming from Halloween celebrations. Make an affordable family night the beginning of a happy, low-cost holiday season. Try it, and stretch your dollar to meet your values. For the People's Marketplace, this is Martina Steiner. Together, we can take back the economy.
Thanks, Martina. And if you missed any of those websites, just check uprisingradio.org after 10 a.m. this morning to find the links that she mentioned. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said on Monday that his agency will investigate irregularities in foreclosure practices. Evidence is mounting that bank procedures, whether intentional or accidental, have resulted in massive foreclosure fraud. After an internal review, Bank of America yesterday reported that it found 102,000 cases where foreclosures were improperly approved. These represent only a small fraction of the cases it will inspect. Reuters reports that the bank, which received billions in bailout funds, proceeded with foreclosures without properly signing paperwork or possessing necessary documentation, such as accurate homeowner payment histories. Industry-wide, there have been reports of bank officials rubber-stamping thousands of foreclosures without reviewing the paperwork. An argument that is also being advanced is that many of the home loans that were aggressively marketed to inexperienced borrowers and approved based on inflated estimates of a home's worth were fraudulent from their conception. By launching its own review, the Fed joins a number of other departments conducting investigations into foreclosure fraud, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Treasury and Justice Departments. In a rare show of nonpartisan national unity, the attorneys general of all 50 states, Republicans and Democrats, are cooperating in investigating foreclosure practices that may have resulted in millions of Americans being kicked out of their homes by banks without the legal authority to evict. My guest is Richard J. Esko. He's a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Welcome to Uprising, Richard.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, what does the term foreclosure fraud mean in this context? Does it mean that the foreclosure of a home itself was done wrong? Or does it also include the any kind of a fraud that might have happened when the loan was made in the first place?
Well, it includes both. And it's exactly the right question to ask, because we're hearing a lot of people now in government and in the business world saying this is a paperwork problem, that the paperwork is not quite correct. That's not right. It's a fraud problem, and it's a fraud from the very beginning of the loan process to the end. The foreclosure fraud we hear about specifically is that on a massive scale, banks have been filing foreclosure notices with the courts, and they've either been fraudulently forging documents, or they've been making statements in affidavits that are supposed to be like sworn testimony that they know are false. Statements like, in effect, we can't find the paperwork right now, but we know we have it, and we have all the necessary supporting documentation. We have people saying that they were hired, you know, beauticians and, you know, people from all walks of life, and generated as many as 500 of these statements a day. So the foreclosure fraud specifically is the forging of paperwork or the fraudulent statements in order to initiate foreclosures, but really the loans themselves were very often generated under fraudulent circumstances.
Now, does it? Do you think that these banks might have generated this vast number of foreclosures and, you know, pushed them into happening in order to try to cover up the bad loans that were made in the first place?
Well, I think it's, in a sense, I mean, I think that they are pushing these foreclosures through for a variety of reasons, but one of which is that I don't think it really occurred to them that they would be caught at it. I think they've been so well treated at every step of the way and so enabled, as they say in the 12-step world, in all their criminal behavior, that I don't think it occurred to them they'd experience much pushback. I mean, after all, in Florida, they were given fast-track court system custom-made just to help them through this process, and in other places they've been given a lot of assistance. So I think they just thought they could foreclose on these homes with impunity because they've done so much else with impunity.
Now, because many of these mortgages were bundled together and sold from one bank to another, and sometimes not even to banks in the lead-up to the financial crisis, how were banks even determining who owned the mortgages?
Well, that's an important issue. Here's what happened. What would happen typically is that when a group of these mortgages were bundled and sold to another bank, they'd have an independent company come in and review them, and they might review a selected number of the mortgages and say, hey, we found that a significant number of these aren't properly documented. What the banks would do then, the bank that was buying, would not say, well, it's unacceptable for me to take mortgages that aren't properly documented. What they would say instead was, that's a great way to negotiate the price down a little bit so we can get these even cheaper.
Hmm.
So they'd use that as leverage to buy the bundled mortgages at a lower price, but not to say, hey, you know, it would be unlawful to close on these things. That was just another deal point for them. So they knew going in that they were getting a certain number of mortgages for which there was no proper paperwork.
So give us a sense of what a typical foreclosure that has now been determined to be fraudulent looked like or happened as it unfolded. You know, it could be with a family who was given a loan that they couldn't afford to begin with, but sold the loan unbeknownst to them. And then what, the bank just came in after the financial crash and decided and basically told them that they were going to foreclose since they couldn't make their mortgage payments and just hired anybody that they could to do the paperwork. Is that essentially how it's unfolded typically?
It would actually, there are these companies called loan servicers that collect the payments and do a lot of the paperwork. And then there's a big database that all the banks together have put together to manage all this stuff. And without getting too technical about it, basically it's the banks themselves that do this service function, and they make money no matter what happens. If a loan payment is late and there are extra late fees and charges, they get to keep that money too. So they're really keeping everything for themselves. And here's why this is important. You know, everybody says, who's defending this practice, First of all, they ignore the rampant law-breaking. But then they say, hey, look, these people aren't making their mortgage payments anyway, so they shouldn't get to stay in the home. So what's the problem? Whether the paperwork's fraudulent or not, these people should be evicted from their homes. But that's not really the way it works. The way it works, when you issue a loan, it's a contract. It's an agreement between two parties, the borrower and the lender. Now, what happened on a lot of these loans was that there might be, let's give a simple example. If somebody's kind of on the brink, they can barely make their payments. They make their payment on the 16th of the month, like they've always done, but the new owner of the loan that they don't even know is there says, oh, the 16th is late for us. That's a late payment, and we're going to charge you all this extra money. Hmm. Then they start paying these extra fees they can't afford, and pretty soon they're in foreclosure. Now, they might want to go to court and say, we have an agreement. We signed a contract that says we can wait until the 16th. The bank would go in and say, we can't find the paperwork. Our rule is the 15th, so we're foreclosing on them. Now, you've just taken away that homeowner's right to go to court and defend the contract that they signed. Multiply that by millions of loans, and that's pretty much the sense of the kind of contract breaking the deal, as well as law breaking that's going on in these foreclosures.
Now, what do you make of the response to it from a number of departments that I'd mentioned, including, of course, the Federal Reserve Chairman's announcement that his agency is going to investigate these irregularities, all of the attorneys general of all 50 states. It seems as though in this collective outrage, one voice is woefully missing, and that's the Obama administration, or President Obama directly. Has he taken a little bit of a step back on criticizing these this kind of fraud?
Well, I don't know if he's taken a step back because, I don't specifically recall the step forward on it. He's certainly, the administration tends to be taking the business position on this, which is that the aggrieved parties that they've mentioned, the lower-level administration officials, have been the people who bought these securities, the investors, rather than the homeowners themselves. I think there's a widespread kind of cultural value in Washington as well as New York that says, the homeowners themselves are the wrongdoers here. And I think that's a very, very, very mistaken way to look at this. I mean, I think you have people who were told, oh, you can afford this loan, take it, don't worry about the paperwork, I've got an appraiser who will come up with a good number for your house. And all along, the banks knew that a certain number of these people wouldn't be able to pay their loans, but they figured they could foreclose and flip the house and sell it again. It never occurred to them that the entire market would collapse the way it did, although it collapsed the way it did because of their own speculating and gambling and artificially driving the prices up. So now everybody's worried about keeping the banks whole and keeping the investors whole, but I do wish I heard a little bit more about keeping the homeowners whole and making sure that they're fairly treated in all of this.
So do you think most homeowners who have been had their foreclosures done fraudulently are aware that they may have any kind of legal recourse? And if so, what is the kind of legal recourse that they might have?
Well, it's complex. Look, you have, first of all, you had the government program HAMP, which was supposed to help these homeowners, and banks were legally obligated to work with them. Now, the biggest, most outrageous violator of that program, who used it to extend and pretend, as they say, to drag these loans out, get another year of mortgages from these people, and then foreclose on them anyway, the biggest rule breaker of them all was Bank of America. By far, if you look at the statistics. Now, when this problem came up with foreclosure fraud, the CEO of Bank of America was very sarcastic, and he said, oh, you want to make us do our homework again? Okay, we'll go back and do our homework again. Well, they went back and did their homework and found at least 103,000 foreclosure notices that they had done improperly. That's what they're owning up to, more than 100,000.
Now, the FDIC is being called on to put Bank of America into receivership by a couple of vocal critics of the finance industry. Is this something that is even realistic, and could it actually be something helpful for homeowners?
Sure, absolutely. It would be helpful, and it's certainly realistic from a legal point of view. Whether it's realistic from a business point of, or from a political point of view, I don't know. I mean, you have a great deal of concern, some of it justified, much of it not, about not destabilizing the stock market and what would it do to, you know, investor confidence and all that stuff.
So a massive sort of remediation of fraudulent foreclosures could destabilize the real estate market. That's an excuse that's being raised by many people. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I think that, you know, the real estate market, it could use a little restabilization, a little adjustment. I look at it this way. You have more, at least 25% of houses, maybe more, significantly more now, that are in one way or another underwater or close to underwater, meaning they're no longer worth what the homeowners are paying for them in terms of the loan. So the homeowners are actually subsidizing the banks
mm-hmm.
because there are people out there paying a $500,000 loan for a house that's worth $400,000, in large part because of the misbehavior of the bank that lent them the money.
Well, that's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, so you have each one of those homeowners is in effect bailing out his bank or her bank to the tune of $100,000 or whatever the underwater amount is. Now, it would be great if this widespread criminality on the bank's part was used to renegotiate that relationship and say to the bank, you have to acknowledge that you have a lot of houses on your books that are not worth what you say they're worth, and you know, help that homeowner out, lower the amount of that loan, the principal. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, thinks we need to do that. I think this is the perfect opportunity to do that. That would help out the homeowners. Yeah, the banks would have to take a little hit, but they can afford it now. And that would also get our real estate market back to some rational level and maybe slow down this madness of the rate of foreclosures going on.
Richard, give our listeners a website for your organization.
It's a Campaign for America's Future, which is ourfuture.org.
Ourfuture.org, and we'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Richard Esko, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Richard J. Esko is a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Again, the website, ourfuture.org. We've been talking about the massive foreclosure fraud across the country. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Antonio Gonzalez will join us to discuss the Latino vote and what that means in next week's election. Stay tuned.
KPFK Radio welcomes Grammy Award-winning Brazilian recording star Javan coming to Club Nokia on Friday, November 5th at 8 p.m., bringing his blend of bossa nova, jazz, funk, pop, and samba once again after his extraordinary sold-out performances in 2008. That is November 5th, 8 p.m. at Club Nokia, one of LA's most intimate settings in downtown at LA Live.
Chora, disfarça e chora. Aproveita a voz do lamento que já vem aurora.
Ticket information available by calling 1-800-745-3000. That is 1-800-745-3000. More details at kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
An ad targeting Latino voters in Nevada made national news last week for its surprising message. The commercial urged Latinos to punish Democrats on Election Day by staying away from the polls. The nationwide Spanish-language network Univision quickly pulled the ad, and it was immediately denounced by community groups and Democratic Party candidates who've been working to register and mobilize Latinos. The Don't Vote message was sponsored by a group called Latinos for Reform, which is led by Robert de Posada, a conservative pundit and Republican. Earlier this month, a Pew Hispanic Center survey found that two-thirds of registered Latino voters plan to vote for Democrats. However, in a finding consistent with the national mood, the survey found that Latino Republicans are more likely to actually vote. 63% of registered Latino voters approved of President Obama's job performance, but only 26% said his policies have been helpful to Latinos. Of those surveyed, the top three issues of concern among Latinos are education, jobs, and health care. Immigration ranked fourth among all Latinos and fifth among Latinos registered to vote. In a year in which Latino immigrants have been alternately courted and demonized by candidates and targeted by extreme immigration laws, their voter activity is being closely watched. My guest is Antonio Gonzalez. He's a president of the William C. Velasquez Institute and one of the founders of the National Latino Congress. So he's also the host of KPFK's strategy session, which airs Mondays at 4 p.m. Welcome to Uprising, Antonio.
Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about where Latino voters seem to stand, at least according to this Pew Hispanic Center survey, before we talk about how candidates are treating them. Do you believe these numbers that, for example, that immigration ranks fourth among all Latinos and fifth among Latinos registered to vote, which might be a surprising fact to some listeners?
Pew study is probably an outlier on immigration reform as an intensity issue for Latinos, Sonali. There's been three other surveys that have immigration at the top of the list, tied with jobs and the economy. Although I think there's some regionality. If you're in New Mexico, the issue isn't as important as it is if you're in Florida or Arizona or California. Probably the end of the legislative session has depressed immigration a little bit because people see it's not possible right now. So it's probably not as high as it was, but it's not fourth.
Now, what about Republican versus Democrat Latinos and even independent Latinos? Latinos do tend to sway more towards Democrats, but there are strong conservative tendencies, especially on social issues.
Yeah, there are. Latinos are not really liberals and they're not really.
And actually, Antonio, we're having trouble hearing you. If you don't mind, we're going to call you right back on your phone and try to get a better line. My guest is Antonio Gonzalez. He's the president of the William C. Velasquez Institute. He's also the founder, one of the founders of the National Latino Congreso. And he's the host of KPFK's strategy session, which airs Mondays at 4 p.m. He is going to be is talking with us about the Latino vote in next week's upcoming elections next Tuesday. And by the way, while we wait to get him on the phone, if you want to find out how to vote on the propositions that are also on the ballot, what progressives are suggesting should be the vote on many of the propositions on the ballot, Uprising has covered all of the propositions before our pledge drive. And all you have to do is go to our website, uprisingradio.org, and in the search button, type in the number of the proposition, and you should be able to pull it up. We will have a reprise of all of the proposition interviews on Election Day. Antonio, are you back with us?
I'm back.
Okay, that sounds much better. Okay, so we were talking about Latino political tendencies in this election.
Well, Latinos are not really conservative or liberal. They don't fit into those categories. But on some of the social issues where they're conservative, they really don't see them as public or voting issues. So you have in this election, I think, a pretty clear indication that the vote will be pretty heavily Democratic, maybe 2-1. The question really, though, is turnout. Do you have high turnout, mid turnout, or low turnout? For the Republicans to be successful, and that's the root of the ad that you were talking about, they need low Latino turnout, and therefore they try suppression tactics. This latest one with Latinos for Reform, which is a front group, by the way, is only the latest in a series of suppression tactics. And the Democrats, on the other hand, need high turnout, but they have a problem because they haven't done very much after all the promises they made to the Latino community. And there is a mixed feeling. Latinos like the Democrats in general, but they feel that they haven't delivered, and they don't put all of the blame on the Republican blocking tactics. They think there's been a sort of a Democratic lack of effort, and that's the conundrum for the Democrats. They need high Latino turnout to win. They probably won't get high Latino turnout. They'll get good turnout, but not fantastic.
Now, what about Harry Reid's efforts to put the DREAM Act into the Defense Authorization Bill, which many said was sort of pandering to the Latino vote? And I want to talk about his rival, Sharon Angle, and her position on Latinos in a bit. But do you think Latinos were sort of convinced by that effort, which, of course, failed?
I don't think so. I think they saw it as Harry Reid was in good standing with Latinos as, compared to President Obama and compared to Nancy Pelosi. He'd done more to move the immigration agenda forward, but they didn't. At the end of the day, they saw it, to use a male sports analogy, they saw it as a Hail Mary pass in which the quarterback got sacked. It really never, that effort didn't take off, and there was a lot of frustration. That being said, this tactic in Nevada, I think, has won the election for Harry Reid. I think it's backfired. And telling Latinos not to vote gets them to vote more.
Well, what about Sharon Angle's interesting approach to her Latino constituency, if she has one? Some listeners may have heard of her interesting interaction with a group of Latino students where she essentially was asked about an ad that Rachel Maddow called the most overtly racist ad of 2010, showing a group of white college graduates and then a group of dark-skinned, menacing-looking men that were labeled illegal aliens, quote-unquote, as being, as people that Harry Reid would like to give away white college graduates' entitlements away to. When she was asked about that ad and these men that were sort of scurrying around a fence, she said to these students that she didn't think that they were necessarily Latino. And I'm paraphrasing here. She even went as far as to tell the students that she didn't think that they all necessarily looked Latino, and some of them looked Asian to her. This should be a complete embarrassment. And yet Harry Reid is neck and neck with Sharon Angle.
Well, there's two things going on, Sonali. One is that the Republicans thought they could run very far on the right on an anti-immigrant agenda, and they were trying to repeat Pete Wilson's winning strategy of 1994 in California. And then they ran into the demographic realities that they don't have enough voters in a close election. They need some Latinos on the one hand. On the other hand, Harry Reid, Nevada's a disaster. You know, they have 20% unemployment. It's the worst mortgage foreclosure place in the country, and Harry Reid hasn't delivered legislative change. So he looks bad. On the other hand, you got a kook running against him, and what you end up is with is a neck-and-neck election, which, again, I think because of this Don't Vote Latino ad by these nutty Republicans that Harry Reid may, in fact, pull it out by the skin of his chinny-chin-chin.
I mean, it seems like this is essentially a theme for the entire national electoral landscape. The Republicans seem to really be offering a very frightening alternative, and the Democrats are offering an incredibly ineffective and hypocritical alternative, leaving voters with, not much of a choice. To vote or to not vote is also a big question. You don't show up to vote, the Republicans win. You do show up to vote, you get Democrats, and you get almost nothing.
Yeah, what's happening is, parts of the country flow with the national trend, and then other parts of the country are beyond that. For example, California, Texas, New York, the big states, the mega states, they have their own trends. So in California, we don't see Democratic focus on the federal election, really. There's a lot of focus on the state realities. Prop 19, fighting Prop 23, the gubernatorial race. And I don't think you'll see low Democratic turnout or low Latino turnout. I think you'll see actually pretty good turnout across all groups, Republicans included in this state. So you have a variety of trends going on. But in these other places where they follow the national trend, the choices are pretty dismal here. And you will see old trends reasserting themselves. Red states are going to vote red, blue states are going to vote blue, and the purple states, which went for the Democrats, are going to flip back to the Republicans this time, and that's why there's a lot of Democratic depression in Washington, D.C., because they are headed for a spanking.
Hmm. Well, I want to turn to the gubernatorial race here in California. The main two rivals, Meg Whitman, the Republican candidate, and Jerry Brown, the Democratic candidate, are still, it depends on which poll you look at. One, they're either neck and neck or Brown is leading. But just not so long ago, Meg Whitman had her own embarrassing moment regarding Latinos with the revelation that the housekeeper that she employed for many years was undocumented and was essentially thrown out when she asked for help. Some were calling it her nanny gate moment, even though she wasn't the nanny. Any fallout, you think, from that? Or has Meg Whitman managed to walk away from that whole debacle?
Well, I think this is going to be a watershed election in that regard, Sonali, is that the Latino vote has never been sort of like the big player across the country. And what you're seeing is sort of Latino-themed issues bubbling up in state after state after state. Meg Whitman may very well have lost the election because of the way she dealt with her immigration issue, the nanny or the maid. And she was not doing too bad with Latinos. She was up at about 30%, which is pretty good for a Republican in California. And Brown was only at 50%. Once that happened, the numbers switched, and she's down in the 20s now, and he's up around 60. So that's one. You look at Sharon Engel in Nevada, that's two. And conversely, you look at the Republicans who, they're terrible in immigration, but they decided, well, if I'm going to be terrible in immigration, I might as well run a Latino for governor or senator. And they're doing that with great success in Nevada, New Mexico, and Florida. Probably there'll be two Latino governors and one Latino senator elected after this election. So, for good reasons and for bad reasons, you see sort of the Latino demographic bubbling forth in really at this level for the first time. And both parties, by the way, are putting a lot of money into mobilizing and trying to influence the Latino vote, which is unusual for a non-presidential year.
It seems as though it's almost inevitable, and maybe in two more years after that, we're going to sort of see these trends where finally both parties do begin taking the Latino vote, as it is called, more and more seriously. Do you foresee that happening as demographics change, and also when the census numbers finally come out about exactly what the demographic breakdown of this nation is?
Mondays, I think so. Tuesdays, I think not. It depends on the day of the week. On the one hand, you have a strong case. I mean, we're 12 million Latino voters now. We were 9 million in 2004. We'll be 15 million in 12, up to 20 million in 16. So you think, okay, you have to orient to this voter bloc, which is, we're in a capitalist society. You go to the growing market, right?
Sure.
On the one hand. On the other hand, there's great resistance because, the traditional, in quotes, America sees its cultural hold on the nation potentially slipping. Mm-hmm. And there's great resistance culturally to the growth of not only Latino, but Latino, Black, and Asian sort of emergence as a counter-hegemony, at least theoretically in America. And I think that's in the back of a lot of people's minds. When you look at the anti-immigrant movement, when you look at the Tea Party movement,
there's
Republican stubbornness in going anti-immigrant when they know, it might be good for today, but tomorrow it's going to be bad, but they do it anyway.
Well, Antonio, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we will link to your website at the William C. Velasquez Institute on our site later today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
Antonio Gonzalez is president of the Willie C. Velasquez Institute. He's also the host of KPFK's Strategy Session. You can hear him every Monday at 4 o'clock on this station. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Walter H. Judd once said, "People often say that in a democracy, decisions are made by a majority of the people. Of course, that's not true. Decisions are made by a majority of those who make themselves heard and who vote. A very different thing." You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. Our website is uprisingradio.org.